The Senate Committee on Veterans and Military Affairs will come into session. Colleagues, this is actually our last meeting of the 112th or 2012 regular session, rush session, turbo session, whatever it calls. And if you recall, colleagues, you know, we talked about during the interim of setting, you know, one of the hearing times aside during the short session to, you know, simply invite veterans and citizens to come in and raise their concerns, because so many times, you know, everybody thinks we know the answers, and what we really do is get most of our material and information from our own veterans and from our own constituents. Before we go on, Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In this little vignette from Voices of the Guard, you know, poems of our own Oregon National Guard that have been compiled by Francis Ritchie, is under the chapter called Coping. I figure a lot of us are coping right now, and so I think it'll put our coping in perspective when you consider the coping that our Oregon National Guard has gone through. As soon as I moved into the realm of sniping and went to sniper school, I enjoyed long-range marksmanship, going to ranges. I wanted to get into competition shooting. It actually calms me quite a bit. I think it comes down to that control thing again. It's like shooting a rocket at the moon, such a ridiculously small target. There's a sense of control when I'm successful, when I can hit a pie plate sized steel target at 900 meters away with a bullet, and I hear it ring off of that plate. There's an aha, I did it. That control thing again. I pray a lot. I guess praying and meditation for me are the same thing. Long range shooting is a form of meditation to me, to bring so many different things into one circumstance and being able to focus everything I have onto a singular thing. It even comes as small and minuscule as focusing my breathing and slowing my heart rate in order to squeeze off that round exactly the way I want it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. That's how I cope a lot, too. I'm not sure 900 yards, though. Once in a while, 1275, but it's not very good, very often. That comes with age and having to have bad eyesight, one of the two. Colleagues, what we're going to do to start with, because of modern technology here, and I remember when I was in the sandbox, we had VTCs and teleconferencing, and the picture would come up on the wall and everything else like that, and all the generals thought that was the greatest thing since sliced apple pie, and it was really great. They could talk to each other and interface, you know, for an hour once a week, so on and so forth, but an entire one-third of all communications in the entire combat theater had to be closed down to create the bandwidth in order for them to talk amongst themselves and feel good for an hour. So in the spirit of technology here, first thing this morning, we're going to hopefully get Dr. Paula Kaplan online. And I see technology is working. And so we're hoping it might go gray over in Ways and Means when she's doing this. So are you there, Doctor?
Yes, I'll do my best.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Boquist, and members of the committee. I really feel it's a privilege to get to address you today, and there are many Oregon connections in what I've been doing with and for veterans, and I'll mention them in a moment. I want to say that I will try and be as brief as possible. Since my book about veterans came out last spring, I have had three meetings with different groups.
Doctor?
Yes.
Yeah, unfortunately, the legal people are kicking me under the table here. Can you state your name, too, for the record so that we have it? Thanks.
I'm so sorry. My name is Paula J. Kaplan, C-A-P-L-A-N. I am a fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School and an associate at the Du Bois Institute, both at Harvard University, and I'm a clinical and research psychologist, and I should say also that my most recent of my 12 nonfiction books is about veterans. It came out in 2011, and it's called When Johnny and Jane Come Marching Home, How All of Us Can Help Veterans. To my great delight and amazement, it was just named the top psychology book of 2011 by the Association of American Publishers. And I just thought it was so gratifying because I don't think that veterans get enough attention.
Thank you.
So anything else I should tell you?
No, that's perfectly. You're doing well.
Okay. So I was saying that since the book came out almost a year ago, I've had three meetings with people at the Pentagon, two of those in the last couple of weeks. I'm in D.C. right now. And I've had meetings with the members, the staff of the both the Senate and the House Veterans Affairs Committees in the U.S. Congress. I also met a couple of weeks ago with the head and his staff of the Military Officers Association of America, who support what I'm about to talk about, as does the National Veterans Foundation, a nonprofit called Soldier's Heart. I met with last week with retired Brigadier General Wilma Vaught, who created the National Women Veterans Memorial in Arlington National Cemetery, and it looks like Psychologists for Social Responsibility is probably going to come on board after their next executive meeting. So with each of these people, I've spent about an hour. I'm going to try to do in the rest of my 20 minutes today what I've been talking to them about for an hour. And so let me say, you probably are familiar with the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the U.S. Sea of Goodwill and groundswell of support documents. And I read those and I thought, well, they're wonderful as far as they go. And I've talked to them about this. But my concern is this, that it's twofold. One has to do with to what extent is there really a groundswell of support for veterans? I know people say, thank a vet for their service, they put up the yellow ribbons, they say we support the troops, but it needs to go so much farther than that, as I know the members of this committee are acutely aware. And so I'm concerned about to what extent is there really support, and also, as they say in these documents, the real key is how to get from whatever support there is to get people to take action, to get involved, helping people.
I'll let just pause for a moment, Ms. Kaplan, Dr. Kaplan, if you can hear us. A little technical difficulty.
Technology. Can you hear us?
We can't hear you. Oh, you're just breaking in and out a bit.
Ways and Means is fighting back.
Yeah, I think so. Try and go ahead, and we'll see if we can hear you.
Okay, how's this?
Yeah, okay, we're back, Doctor.
Okay, great. So, in my experience, and I should say, I have not served in the military myself. My late father was a veteran of World War II in the Battle of the Bulge. But my experience is that the vast majority of American civilians who've never served in the military, and that's at least 93% of us, really don't have a clue of what war is like, don't have any understanding of what people in the military have gone through, both at war and then trying to come home and settle back in. And so I've been saying we're a war-illiterate nation for that reason, and I don't think that can continue, especially because, unlike in World War II, it's so easy for people who've never served in the military and who don't have a loved one who has, to just avoid the whole topic of what veterans need and to feel they've done their bit if they've thanked a vet for their service or if they tell other people at parties that they support the troops. This avoidance was brought home to me in the following way, and it's disturbingly stark. I write a blog for Psychology Today, and I started writing about the end of March of last year. In that time, I've written about 60 essays on a wide variety of topics, most of them not related to veterans in any way. About a dozen have been about veterans in some respect or other. And with the exception of one of the articles about veterans, every time I write about vets...
Oops. We're breaking up again here.
We could just go straight to the phone.
Yeah.
It's everybody showing up to work and logging in and
yeah, the
drag on the system.
Okay. Do you want to go phone? Hey, doctor? Are you there?
I think we're going to switch to the phone because we're out of bandwidth. Ways and Means obviously is going into meeting and they're cutting the budget, and so we probably didn't pay AT&T. So we probably lost all this. So are we going to call her back?
I'm not sure how that would be set up to go, but Dr. Kaplan at Cheyenne Ross again, we'll reconnect via phone.
Okay, you have my 301 number in Maryland?
We do. I'm not even sure.
Technology, see, it never works. I could make an Air Force joke, but I see Paul Evans back there, you know, because they're always into the space technology.
Sorry, yes, sir. Rebecca.
We could go into a brief recess if you'd like, or no. Just deal. Oops. There it goes. Did she say use her cell?
Yeah.
Not the hard line?
Cell, she said.
Oh, no. No, the 301.
301 number?
All right. Thank you, Doctor.
Dial 9.
Can we afford this phone bill, Mr. Chairman?
Hey, it's Ways and Means. It's their problem, right? We're just a policy committee.
Hello.
Hey, we're back, Doc.
Great.
Okay.
All right. Sorry for all these interruptions. We're out here in Oregon, you know. We are the left coast.
Well, thank you for your efforts. It's nice to have met you in person. And I have to say, I won't necessarily know who's addressing me now that I can't see you. So please let me know. All right. Well, so did you hear me say something about my Psychology Today blog?
Yes.
Okay, so what was very disturbing was, I've been saying all along, I don't really think that most American civilians ever think about veterans. They don't want to. Why should they? It's upsetting if it doesn't impinge on their lives directly, or they don't know how it affects them or the nation. Then it's unpleasant to think about people who are suffering. And then there it was. On my Psychology Today blog, they show me how many views each of my essays has gotten. And with the exception of one of my dozen essays about veterans, all of the others get between 30% and 3% of the views that any other subject I ever write about gets. So there are some hard numbers. And I think that as long as veterans remain very isolated, which many of them are, I've gone all over the country listening to vets from World War II through to the current wars, and a lot of them talk about how isolated they are. And I can tell you, as a psychologist, we don't know many things. We say we do, but we don't know many. But one that's really been very well documented is that isolation tends to make just about any kind of emotional pain worse, and community connection and human connection tends to make it more bearable. So when the veterans have told me why they get so isolated, a major reason that they talk about is they think that they're mentally ill, they feel crazy, or they've been told that they are, or they're afraid that if they talk to us, we'll think that they are. So there's a vicious cycle going on. And according to, and what the nature of the cycle is that people come back from war. They are often emotionally devastated. They're in moral anguish and conflict because of what they've experienced and because of the difficulties in trying to make this huge culture shift of going from military culture to the culture back home, going from a place where the goals are to defend and to attack, destroy, and kill to back home where the goals have to be very, very different. And so what happens is when they're experiencing these emotional and moral difficulties, then we call them mentally ill. We say they have post-traumatic stress disorder, which, as you know, appears in the Diagnostic Manual of Mental Illnesses. Now, it's very clear that there's suffering going on, but I keep asking people to consider, if being upset, if being disturbed by war is a mental illness, then what exactly would be a healthy response to having been through those kinds of experiences. And of course, you have to get a psychiatric label in order to get therapy and drugs paid for. And those are the two most common forms of treatment. When I met with people at the Pentagon, I said, I think I now understand something better than I did before. The people in the military and the people in the VA see this suffering up close more than anybody else, and they wanted to help. And they said, emotional suffering, who knows how to fix that? And they looked around and they said, ah, the mental health system does. And it was understandable that they would think that, but I can tell you as a therapist, I can tell you as somebody who has trained graduate students who are therapists in training, as someone who has talked extensively to colleagues in psychology, psychiatry, social work, and so on, that we do not get trained, and we don't train our students to deal with the kinds of things that people go through at war and then trying to readjust when they come home. So if you look at the press releases from the military and from the VA since the Iraq War started, you see a pattern, and I document this in detail in my book. It's very disturbing. The top brass will announce that the indices of emotional suffering keep increasing, whether it's suicide, homelessness, substance abuse, family breakdown. And then they say, so here's what we're going to do. And then they describe the traditional mental health approach. They say, we're hiring hundreds more therapists. We're okaying the use of many more psychiatric drugs. We're sending more therapists and more drugs into the combat zones directly, and on and on and on. And yet, the next press releases, they say, and these indices of suffering still keep going up. So where that leaves us is that even if we assume that every therapist in the military, in the VA, in the private sector is terrific, and even if every psychiatric drug was helpful and not hurtful, which is not the case, as the top brass have been expressing concern about, then clearly something more is needed. Now, and I think that something more needs to come from civilians. I spoke with Dr. David Collier, whom you may know. He's head of the Vet Center in Salem, Oregon. And I quote him in my book. I said, you know, you are the only therapist of any kind that any of the vets I listened to in working on the book said was ever helpful to them. And I want to know, what is it you feel you do that's helpful? And he told me, and it was the same thing the vet said. He listens respectfully. He tells them they don't have to hurry through it. He's got lots of time. He forms a connection with them. He really cares. And I said to him, well, that's really interesting. What is it that you do? That is what the vet said was helpful to him. I said, what is it that you do that any non-therapist could not do? And he said, absolutely nothing. He said, you know, in our training programs, we sort of pussyfoot around and we talk about empathy, but it's really about love. And whatever techniques you use and whatever therapeutic approaches you use, if it's helpful to the vet, it's because of the human connection. Now, because of what he said, and I'm trying to summarize briefly here, and because of what I heard from so many vets who said either that therapists were not helpful to them or that they were nice and they were supportive, but they really hated being branded as sick. They would say, I'm sick of being called sick. I go for a job interview, and I say I'm a vet, and they all assume, ah, I have PTSD, that's a mental illness, and therefore they don't want to hire me. And so I thought, well, you know, the part of what's going on here is that the mental health professionals are saying, well, we know how to fix all this, but unfortunately they can't. And then the civilian non-therapists think in this very psychiatrized country that we live in, a lot of civilian non-therapists have said to me, well, I don't think there's anything I can do to help vets because they're mentally ill and I'm not a therapist. So when they come back and they're diagnosed with a mental illness, the one advantage, well, two advantages. One is their therapy gets paid for, but as we're seeing, that's not enough. And also, very often, it's the only time anyone is conveying to them the message, we believe you're suffering. But you know what? We shouldn't have to say, we will believe that you're suffering and we'll try to help you, but you have to let us call you mentally ill. I've been working in the field of psychiatric diagnosis for more than a quarter of a century, and that's what got me into the work about veterans, because I was on two of the committees that wrote the current edition of the Psychiatric Diagnostic Manual, the DSM. And I teach research methods. One of my books is about that. I really care about good quality science. And as you probably know, that manual is marketed as a scientific document. Well, I quit those two committees that I was on because when there was bad science that fit with what they wanted to do, they used it, and they didn't say it was junk science. When there was good science that went against what they wanted to do, they would distort it, they would ignore it, they would just shove it out of the way. Psychiatric diagnosis, first of all, it's not scientifically based, but most people think it is, and I've written two books about this. Secondly, once you get a psychiatric label, you become almost completely likely to be treated according to a medical model. And what that tends to mean these days is you're given psychiatric drugs, usually many psychiatric drugs at one time if you're a vet. There's been no research on how these drugs interact. And the research is really very persuasively showing that they tend to do more harm than good. They do help some vets sometimes, and I would never deny any vet access to anything that might help, but more is needed. So what I've been trying to encourage people to do, I've created a project that doesn't cost anything, and I call it the Welcome Johnny and Jane Home Project, and it just involves every civilian listening to a veteran's story from any war, listening without judging, listening with respect. And I literally, there's a video on my website that I sent the link for, just a little 10-minute video in which I talk about how to do the listening sessions. And it really, there are only two sentences that you speak at all. I'll tell you if you want to ask during question period. I'm just trying to save some time here. But when people say, you mean we don't need training to do these sessions? I'm not a therapist after all. I say, no, you don't need training, because we used to call this friendship. We used to call it human connection. We used to call it community support. And there's a wealth of really well-done research that shows that these kinds of things are healing. We did a study at Harvard Kennedy School last summer of having civilian non-therapists listen to veterans from World War II. We had a 93-year-old veteran through to the current wars. They just listened. The sessions would go on for about 2 or 3 hours. And then right afterward and a month later, we asked the veterans, how was that for you? What if anything was positive? What if anything was negative? And every single one said, this is the first time I've been able to talk without anybody asking me to explain military terms, or ask me what they want to know, rather than giving me the time and space to say what I would like to say and haven't had a chance to say. Many of them said it was the first time that they had remembered certain things, or had been able to put certain things together and understand them better. And most of all, what these listening sessions do is they make sure that there are people in the veterans community that have heard their stories, that are not war illiterate, and that understand, so that the isolation that comes from being concerned that nobody back here gets it starts to be broken down. And then one of the two sentences I'll just mention that I urge people to say toward the end of the session is, because vets have said this is so helpful to them, is, if I had been through what you've described, I'm sure that I, too, would be having the feelings and the experiences and the sleeplessness and so on that you're having. And I hope you know that's an understandable human reaction. It's not a mental illness, and you're not crazy. Now, none of this precludes somebody seeing a therapist or taking psychiatric drugs. But it's a way of saying to vets, we understand that you're suffering, we understand that you're very isolated, and you can make these human connections without anybody calling you mentally ill. I want to just say real quickly a couple more things and then tell you some things that I would love to see the Oregon State Legislature do, and then I'll be open to questions. One is about the term post-traumatic stress disorder. As you may know, it was created with the best will and intentions in the world, because after the Vietnam War, people were not paying attention to how many veterans were suffering. And so the people who conceived of this term and this category really wanted to get people to notice the suffering and to try to do something about it. And they understandably, back then, thought that a way to do this would be to get it into the psychiatric manual. Well, when they put it in the manual back then, they had a sentence in there that they then took out. Nobody knows why. And the sentence went like this. This is a normal reaction to an abnormal situation. So it was kind of strange. It was bizarre in a way, because here was this category in the manual of mental disorders, but it said it's a normal reaction to an abnormal situation. But at least there was that way of you could show it to the vet and you could say, there's nothing weird about you. There's no reason you should have been over this by now. You're not having some kind of strange reaction that nobody else would have. But now everybody thinks of, oh, PTSD is a mental illness. Stay away from them. It distances the rest of the country from vets. It makes us think that they are different in some kind of grotesque or scary way from the rest of us. And then there are two other problems with the use of post-traumatic stress disorder. One is that there's no word for war in there. So if you tell me, a civilian, that a vet has PTSD, I don't really begin to understand how is that different from somebody who has PTSD or who's traumatized because they were hit by a bus or because they were raped or because they were in a tsunami. And all of these things are disturbing and scary, but they are very different from each other. And since we need more connections and understanding between vets and civilians, we have to stop using that word and go back to words and terms that were used before. In the Civil War, they called it soldier's heart. Then it was called shell shock, combat fatigue, war trauma, words that novelists and poets use like profound grief, loss of innocence, moral anguish, shame and guilt and fear. And that makes our common humanity with vets much clearer and creates more understanding and reduces isolation. Now, I sent you the Kennedy School study about the effects of the listening project, and I just want to say real quickly, when we asked the civilians, listeners, what was it like for you, a common response went like this: I discovered we have so much in common. And I thought, well, in a way, that's sort of chilling. I think the assumption of a lot of civilians is, if you're a vet and I'm a civilian, we have absolutely nothing in common, which is another reason for us to listen. Now, just briefly, the last thing I want to mention before some requests is that yesterday, on the Harvard Kennedy School website, we put the following information. I had convened a conference there last November 2nd called A Better Welcome Home, Transformative Models for Helping Veterans and Their Families, because we know that even in the military here and there, and even in the VA here and there, there are approaches people are using to helping veterans who are suffering without calling them mentally ill and without using a lot of drugs or bringing in other high-risk approaches. And so this conference consisted of almost 30 presentations from all over the country, from the VA, from the military, from nonprofits, from individuals, people working with the arts, through the arts to help veterans heal, training service dogs, creating connections like through the Listening Project, outdoor exercise, mindfulness and meditation. And each of these people spoke for just 5 minutes. Now, these five-minute videos are on the website, and they just looked at the camera and said, here's how we help veterans heal. And yesterday, an email went out to more than 18,000 email addresses to every, some of them would have gone to Oregon, because it went to every large to moderate municipality in the country. It went to many veterans organizations, civic, political, social, and faith-based groups, and here's what the letter said, and we would love it. You would be willing to participate in getting the word out there in Oregon. The letter said, we know that a lot of Americans want to help, but they don't know what they can do to help. And so here is the link to the Kennedy School website. Go on there, scan down the list of the 29 programs. Choose a few that grab your interest personally. When you click on any of these, you'll see three things. One is a five-minute video that's about this approach or this program. The second is the name and contact information of the person who's speaking, and you are urged to get in touch with them. And the third is a list of 3 to 5 ways that you can help with this program. You can do it in your locality. You can go there and help them. You can send a donation. You can educate other people about it. So we want this to be a major education project of the about the various alternative approaches to helping vets heal, and we want it to be a major action and involvement program. So that's one of the things I would love to talk with you about, how the Oregon could help with that. And then the other kinds of things include educating people through PSAs, locally or statewide, through training sessions for therapists, clergy, and others about these different kinds of approaches and about the listening sessions, which cost nothing or only minimal amounts. And then the last thing I want to mention, and I think this may be what somebody there had heard about originally and led you to get in touch with me, is that right after my book came out, a veteran named Ted Engelman, a Vietnam vet, who lives in Denver, Colorado, called me and he said, you know, I was reading about the listening sessions and I love this idea and I think there should be a National Day of Listening to Veterans. So I got in touch with members of Congress and U.S. Congressman Robert Filner from California has introduced House Resolution 456 and Congressman Rangel from New York has supported it. And I want it introduced in the U.S. Senate too. But this could be done in the state legislature too, and it's very, very simple. The resolution declares in U.S. Congress case a National Day of Listening to Veterans, and it just says on Veterans Day every civilian shall listen with respect and without judgment to a veteran's story. And it's a way of getting people involved. It's a way of dignifying the idea and of the importance of doing this kind of work. And it's something that absolutely anybody can do. It can be done through a Girl Scouts group. It can be done through the Junior League or Kiwanis or the Better Business Bureau or faith-based organizations. So let me stop there, and I would love to answer any questions, and I will send you some more materials. I'll send you the link to the Harvard Kennedy School website, and I would love to be in touch with you in the future if you have any questions or anything I can do for you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Senator Monis Anderson, any questions?
Yes. I think this issue is really, really complex, and I have not read your book, but there are, I think, individual reactions to military training, combat training, actual war, and there are some who come with a different emotional makeup. Some may even be very borderline bipolar, borderline schizophrenic, borderline, where they are able to are very high functioning and don't really need intensive service. And I would think that the experiences, their reaction to the experiences that they have in the military would be different than another veteran who didn't have that. Do you address that at all?
Yes, I think it's really, I should say, whenever I talk about these alternative approaches, is because we're all accustomed to thinking along the lines of the traditional psychiatric approaches and the medical model, sometimes I don't make it clear enough, and I'm sorry that I didn't in this case, that I'm not saying let's do all this instead of the traditional approaches. There are people who are seriously disturbed by any stretch of the imagination, and that probably would have been even without going to war and trying to come home. And so this is not to intended to exclude at all, and I talked to the Military Officers Association about this, this is not at all intended to exclude anything else that somebody might need. It's just... In fact, what often happens is, and I probably discussed this, is that often somebody who's in the service or somebody who's a veteran and depends on VA benefits will say, I don't want to go see a therapist because it could interfere with my career advancement. I might not be able to get security clearance, and I would just feel so ashamed if I get a label. But so they get isolated and they don't talk to anybody, and things just get worse. It just snowballs. So this is a very, like the listening session or participating in a meditation group as they do at the Seattle VA. That's a way of breaking down the isolation, of getting somebody to start opening up and to make connections. And then, you know what, if that's not enough, then they are more likely to seek help of other kinds, because there's a connection and because they don't feel helpless and hopeless, and because whoever is working with them, whether it's the leader of the meditation group, whether it's one of our listeners who can guide them to where they can get other kinds of help. But this is often a way in to getting other kinds of help. The clergy are wonderfully important, because there too, you're not afraid that you're going to get a diagnosis, get a label. You can lose, if you get any of these labels, you can lose custody of your children, you can lose your job, although that's not supposed to be legal, but you know, they say, oh, it's just a personality problem or conflict. You can lose your health insurance because now you have a pre-existing condition. At the VA, of course, getting a label is often exactly what you need in order to get the services that they provide. But here, too, I think that that the state veterans offices could do a terrific job of trying to help vets who don't want to get a label for whatever reason, or don't feel ready yet to go see a therapist, of trying to help them find these alternative kinds of services as a way of offering something that has been shown to be healing, as these alternative approaches have. And then it's, as I say, it's a way in, so that if they need other kinds of help, they're more likely to be able to get it, and somebody can help guide them to it.
Just a follow-up.
Follow-up from Senator Mona Sanderson.
Males don't like to talk about feelings a whole lot. I mean, women do. And so it's hard for me to imagine getting a group of men. I think they need to be separated, women and men, in certain circumstances, because a lot of issues that the women have over there have to deal with the interactions that they have had with men. But, you know, it seems like pie in the sky to me to... that these men would come in and really want to open up. I mean, I don't relate to that yet.
Yes. Well, Senator Mona Sanderson and Senator Mr. Chairman, Senator Boquist, and members of the committee, let me respond to that, because it's really important. What we have found, the reason that I did the study at the Kennedy School of the Listening Project, was because my own experience and the experiences of other civilians offering to listen to the veterans' stories had gone as followed. We were surprised. I mean, my work up until I started focusing on veterans specifically, and that's both women and men, has been a lot on women's issues. And so I thought, too, gee, I wonder if they're going to say anything. You know, I want to give them a chance to talk, and I was working on my book, which was how I got started on this, and so I wanted to listen to what they had to say, what their concerns were, their problems, what they had found helpful, and I was astounded by how many of them wanted to talk. And so, and what actually becomes relevant here is the sentence that I put together that I urge people to use to begin the listening sessions was constructed very carefully with lots of advice and input from veterans, and it goes like this. You say to the veteran, this also reflects the fact that this is apolitical. It doesn't matter what my politics are, it doesn't matter what the veteran's politics are. The sentence goes like this: as an American whose government sent you to war, I take some responsibility for what you experienced there and trying to come home. And if you want to talk, I will listen for as long as you want to speak, and I will not judge. Now, it has been astonishing to me. I have not had a single vet, male or female, say, no, I don't want to talk. But some people have written to me and said, I don't feel ready to do a listening session, but I'd like to do something. And so there's a section on my website called Vets Tell Their Stories, where anonymously or not, they can go there, they can write their story, they can write a bit of a story, or a poem, or a thought, a fragment, anything that they want, anything to start breaking down the isolation. Now, you're right that because the way they have been socialized and because of military training, men don't usually start out by opening up emotionally in a big way, but they'll start by telling their story. And then feelings will come up. They saw somebody close to them get blown up over there. Or they only saved two of their buddies when they wanted to save five. And so the feelings do come up. And it's just been very gratifying to see how many of them say, nobody has ever given me a chance to talk before. So they make the decision about how much they're going to talk about their feelings, how much they're going to show their feelings. But in most cases, they do. But at the very least, because trauma, one of the effects of trauma is emotional and cognitive fragmentation, just getting to even speak pieces of their story is a way for them very often to start to pull stuff together and not feel so bewildered and sort of at the mercy of these memories that keep hitting them from here and there and all sides. And I want to say something about the women. And by the way, any vet who doesn't want to talk, of course, doesn't have to. That's why we say, if you want to talk, I will listen for as long as you want to speak. And then for anybody who doesn't feel ready, we can offer them the option of starting by writing something on this website. Or one of the people who spoke at the Harvard conference at the Kennedy School was Jason Hansman from Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. And we had invited him because he has started this phenomenal online way for vets to talk to each other. And, of course, that's what the vet centers in the VAs were originally designed to do. And so often they want to talk to each other before they talk to a civilian. And that's great, but I don't think we should leave it at that, because there's a lot of research showing that if you spend most of your time with people who've been through the same kind of trauma that you have, the parts of you that have nothing to do with the trauma, you know, you like foreign films, or you like to cook, or you like to go for what, all of that just doesn't get used, and so you are in danger of becoming just the trauma and the horror that you live with, and that tends to increase the rate of suicide. So bringing them into connection with the wider community and with places where they can focus on creativity and connection rather than defending and destroying is really healing. Now, just one other comment I want to make in response to what you said about women, because it's very interesting. You're absolutely right that women in general are more likely to socialize, to talk, open up, you know, get your feelings out, connect with other people. But the women vets in the study, and it wasn't a huge study because we didn't have much money, but the women vets in the Kennedy School study last summer were more reluctant to open up. And they would talk about that. They would say, you know, when I was in the military, I felt I had to be tougher than the guys. I had to hide my feelings more than the guys. One of the women vets who was one of the first people whose story I ever listened to is named Michelle Dillow, and she has given me permission to use her name. And she talked about how there was this big guy that everybody just loved, and he was blown in half by an IED. And she said that night, nobody talked about it. Nobody cried. Nobody said they were sad. She said, and I couldn't even look at anybody, and the silence just about killed me. And when she came home, she couldn't connect with her friends and family anymore because she had all these powerful, disturbing feelings inside her and so much rage. And her experience was very much like what I've heard from a lot of women vets, which is, I don't know if I should go on being a good soldier and being tough and not talking about my feelings, or if I'm supposed to go back to being what a quote-unquote good woman is supposed to be, and I don't know how to get from one to the other. There's a wonderful group called Sunergos, S-U-N-E-R-G-O-S, that I've been talking with the person who runs that. She's a veteran herself, and with Kate Dahlstedt, who's one of the founders of Soldier's Heart in New York State, we've been talking about trying to identify some of what's missing for women. And Sunergos has just done its first, or in November they did their first 3-day retreat for women who've been in the military and who are trying to make the shift. And she said, she wrote to me because she read my book, and she said, you know, I realized a lot of what we do is an elaborate form of listening. And I have now been in touch with some of the women who went through that retreat, and they said it was just transformative. It was exactly what they needed. And as you say, Senator, it was important for them not to be with men in that situation. And, oh, sorry, one other thing in response
We're going to have to wrap up here in a minute, Doctor.
Okay. Well, one other thing in response to what Senator Manas Anderson asked was that in my listening project, it's not done in groups, so it's not a bunch of guys or women and men mixed in. It's one civilian listening to one veteran, but there's an organization that does something called Veteran Civilian Dialogues, and they too are on the Kennedy School website. They were at our conference. They're based in New York, and they get groups of veterans and civilians together in a highly structured way, and they, in a somewhat different way from what we do, have tremendous things happening as well.
Just once, hopefully you can make it short, but did you study at all the civilian listener versus a one with a military background listener?
No, we didn't, and I would love to be able to do that. There's not a lot of funding available for this kind of work, but I know that some vets have said I'd rather talk to somebody who's been through it, and for some, they would just as soon talk to a civilian because. When they're looking at a civilian, they don't associate them with the difficulties that they've had. For others, they want to talk to another veteran first or to a therapist who's had a military background, as Dr. Collier in Salem, Oregon has had.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Doctor. We're going to move on in the meeting, and you're welcome to stay on the phone. It's interesting because we have, you know, not a large number, but a group of veterans out here, and sometimes they're shaking their head yes when you're talking, and sometimes they're shaking their head no when you're talking. And so we're kind of doing our own, you know, scientific study out here right now to kind of see what's going on out there. But we appreciate the information you have. And if you could get a copy of the email letter you sent out to Cheyenne that we can distribute to the other 90 members of the chamber, of the two chambers, so that they have some resource they can send on. Because many times, I think as you rightfully point out, that Senator Mona Sanders, some things work for some people and some things don't work for others, and it's kind of a variety that goes across the spectrum that's out there. But you're welcome to stay on board. We're going to ask a couple of veterans to come up, and I guess you could say, tell us what they'd like to say. I'm going to ask Peter Barkley to come up and Tina Olson to come up right now, if they would, to the podium here. And Doctor, you're welcome to stay, or you can go back to work writing.
Well, I'm afraid I have to catch a plane, so this was canceled.
Thank you.
But I wish I could hear what the veterans are going to say. Is that going to be available somewhere?
It is available, and I'll have Cheyenne email you the link, and you can listen to it, because I know Peter was nodding his head and thinking of comments to say. So, and they will be on the tape at about the 55-minute mark into the hearing. So you can kind of, if you go to the legislative webpage and Cheyenne will send it to you, you can actually slide forward and listen to the testimony. So those of us that always stick our foot in our mouth because we say too much are well quoted. So
thank you,
Doctor.
Thank
Have a good day.
You so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Do you want to let ladies go first?
It does, how do I turn this on? The overhead, I have a power slide.
It's supposedly in the moving there. Is it working? Okay. Here we go.
Hi, my name is Tina Olson, veteran advocate. I want to thank you all, especially Senator Boquist and Senator Anderson, for taking part in the Military Child Education Coalition. That's a very big part of what I do in this state, is just listen to veterans. But what I did when I was asked to do this, I'm down at PSU a lot, in Clackamas Community College, and down at PCC. And I just listen to random veterans of all their aches, pains, and, you know, so much. But what I did is I put together a slide and giving certain criteria of what a normal veteran is going through versus every era across the board. And I called it crisis on the home front. And the reason I called it that was because we're not in crisis because we're not in war anymore. This is, when they're coming home, this is the war ground. This is where we need to emphasize.
Tina, can you tell us where you served, what, and when you served?
I served in the U.S. Army. I did multiple tours, as in my first tour of duty was in Camp Casey, Korea, up on a DMZ. I've done Kosovo, Mogadishu, Desert Storm, Desert Shield.
Thank you.
So I've been around. I'm also a survivor of PTSD. And also an MST victim. So I have had multiple things that have happened to me, but this is why I have passion to do this job. And anyone that knows me knew I have passion. So, but I want to go on with the filling the void and building trust, because that is a huge, as she explained, that is a huge issue with veterans in this state. What we have is, first and foremost, is we have multiple resources, as in Fort Oregon, and I believe that, let me go here, I believe that in this process of building trust, we have three different emphases that we need to build trust in. First and foremost, we need a resource line in this state drastically that actually not deals with a suicide line. We need one that's non-threatening, to where a soldier can call and just get the basic run-of-the-mill resources, which we have tons of them in the state. We just don't have them in one space. Okay? And then, as she explained, me dealing with a lot of veterans, they do not feel comfortable if they are not speaking with another veteran. And that's just the way it is. There are some veterans that will be more likely to talk to you, but unless you've been through it and you understand their feelings, they are not going to indulge on any information whatsoever until they feel that you are talking to them on a one-to-one basis, and when you explain your tours to their tours, it's like they will open up to you. But it takes trust. They're just not trustworthy at first. The law enforcement, that's a huge issue right now. I am talking to a lot of veterans on a day-to-day basis that has been through the system already. And these are 20-year-olds. That most of them are addicted to heroin. They've already been through the process, and they've been through the Clackamas County jail system, the Salem, Portland, and no one is making it well known out there for the SB Bill 999. I just don't think there's adequate enough information out there to tell these soldiers about that bill at all. And also the financial problem plagues, that's a huge issue with the home foreclosures. I can tell you when a veteran is in need of financial matters, he will wait to the very last moment to seek help until their house is either getting foreclosed on or their bills are not being paid. They just don't know where to go, and that's just where it is. And what I've heard about the younger veterans is the families. I've talked to a lot of wives to where their TRICARE benefits are getting renegotiated. And it is making it so hard to stay on TRICARE, which they double and triple their amount of money they pay each month. So it's making that hard to where to stay on, have health care for their family. Because the veteran's taken care of. It's just the family that's not at this point. And what I also believe with the campus VSOs, there's very few and far between of them, and that is essential because not only is that veteran told when he was in the military how to access those lines and those paths to take as a veteran, when they go into the school system, they do not know their path. And I believe the VSOs on the campuses give them that transitional point of reference to where they need to go. What do they need to take? And that's just not happening. Most of them at this point, especially through Clackamas, they're dropping out of college. And also, this is what I learned about the job presses, including myself when I got back. I reference it to being on patrol. You know, it's tedious, it's boring, it often seems uneventful. You know, expect it, time, take action, we'll go speeding by. But if you get sidetracked and discouraged or a lack of thereof, you will miss that opportunity. You know, and using the post 9/11 bills, this is another one I talked to younger veterans about, was just recently attending college that the 4 to 8 months of your basic allowance for housing is proportioned if full-time student with a loss, which can be up to 50% of the BAH, because of the state did not want to contribute to the GI Bill for the Title 32 soldiers. That is a huge loss. That's why some of them are dropping out, because of that, the summer months. Also, I admire the reintegration team, I really do, and I know they can only do what they can do, but we have a program here, Oregon Hire Vets. That isn't the most especially if you have PTSD, they have wonderful transition programs there. And they get paid, you know, where they go to go work. And they give not only the employer for the first 6 months half of their money to train this soldier. That's an important program of putting them back to work. But also, they have classes there to teach the veteran to translate their military career into normal sentences to get rid of those acronyms. That is a huge part. And this is the ODVA's website, which this is what we have at this point right now. And they did this back in 2010, the amount of veterans. And I was concerned about the Vietnam veterans in the state, you know, because that is a high amount. And what I've been doing with Vietnam veterans lately is because those guys are mostly retired now from work. And most of them, Vietnam veterans are the ones that they're guilt-ridden, but more importantly, they don't want to take help. They say, you know, I don't need help at this point. But you know what they're doing right now is there's a program down in Clackamas Community College, which is the water treatment facility. They train them for 2 years to be for water treatment. And I have a lot of Vietnam vets in right now to get retrained in that program. They're getting voc rehab. So I feel that there's just not adequate amount of information out there for Vietnam vets. I just don't think they realize what they're capable of getting. And this is an up-to-date 2012 of the member and non-member states. There's still 10 states at this point that are non-member of any post that is located on their state. And that's up-to-date information.
What's the caption?
The member and non-member. The ones in red are non-member.
Of what?
Of what?
Post in the state. I mean, there's no post located in that states.
What's a
military
post?
Facilities.
Oh, a military facility. Yeah.
Okay. And this is what I did. I went last week and got the Department of Labor as 2011. And what we have is OEF, OIF veterans are 13% unemployed rate. Overall, it's 9.9, but other areas is 8.6. So that was concerning to me. Also, if you go to military.com, they just took a current poll of what does a veteran, these are younger veterans most of the time, but what are they suffering from? What are they realizing when they get back if they want to make a career? And the highest one was able to translate military careers and their skills. That was the hardest, 76%. And the financial and legal problems, this is a very dear project to me, because what I did is I went down to the prison systems and got what it would cost for a soldier to go through the prison systems. And at this point in time, it would cost $20,000 to keep that soldier in prison. Versus if we go to a veterans court system in this state, it would only cost $3,500 or less into a diversion program. And that is significant amount of money that if we get a veteran court system into the state. There's a few that are doing it. Ontario is very productive with it right now. I do think that it's cost effective. With the home foreclosures, like I said, they wait to the last minute to even seek help. I think sometimes we physically need a centralized hub in this state for resources. And employment issues a factor. And like right now, with the rollout of Obama's plan, Job Act, a lot of people don't know within 28 days that an employer has to file for that soldier to be working with them, or they will not get that credit, that tax credit. And they have 28 days. So, I mean, it's just information that's not getting out there enough. And this is what I really thought about problem solving with everything in the state that we have. I believe that we need to create a certain member task force, and that is including state agencies, county agencies, and nonprofits for veterans to get together, because what I learned about MSEC was I had all these state facilities talking to me about programs that I have never known or even accessed for veterans. I have never known about them, and it would help. And I believe if we translate that out to the VFWs, the American Legions, the IAVA, the SVA, there is 51 area veterans programs in this state, but no one gets that information out to them correctly or sufficiently in enough time. As working with the veteran advocacy, we need to work with them on a day-to-day basis of getting that information out, because those are the people that's on the ground talking to these veterans. I do believe that, and my heart is the counties and college VSOs, we have to get those back on target to get actually the adequate enough advocacy out there for them. You know, older veterans and heirs with the money's assistance for emergencies, I believe, because in the state of Washington, what they have right now is they have a certain set, a portion of state money set aside for older veterans, the Vietnam veterans, Desert Storm veterans, and at this point, and they take that money, I think it's out of land resources, but I'm not for sure. I want to get that to you guys to make sure, because that was a really good bill up there, because the older veterans up there are receiving monies for that part instead of the newer veterans. And we definitely need to make a clearinghouse. You know, Fort Oregon has not updated their resources within a year. And that's primarily what the National Guard use, is the Fort Oregon website. I'm here today because I've been working on this program. It's called the 2-in-1. And I believe in this program because I've been working with them single-handedly. And right now, there is one program down in San Diego that has this page already up and running, and their numbers, they track with adequate numbers. Basically, they know every era, every person that calls into that team. And they're willing to do this page for us, the 2-in-1 people, for $160,000. And I think it's well managed. I think what we're going to have is a live chat. We're going to also have downloadable files. And what we also can do is basically do a Twitter feed. And if you notice the view calendar, they can also go to this website. It's non-threatening. But also they can find out what is in your area that's going to be up and running, like the Yellow Ribbon Affairs, whatever, the reintegration summits, wherever they need to go. This will be a one-page source to where they can go and download and not feel threatened. But also we'll have another tab on there for families and spouses, so they can actually go and receive help.
So who pays, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Who pays?
Well, this is the San Diego one, and it's the commissioners. Every county commissioner goes in and supports this program.
Okay.
And here they're willing to do this with us for $160,000 if we support that. But what I like about it is we can advertise it in a way, because in this state they have 8 hubs around this state. But what is unique about this program, it will connect the veterans not only with the veteran advocacy people, but also with the state agencies, with the county agencies, and with the state of Oregon. So not only will they know everything in the state that is handed to them, but also on the veterans advocacy part. So the soldier will get taken care of all the way around. If he wants to be put on assistance, whatever, social services, if he gets electric cut off, we can connect him with that agency. And right now, it goes in between 1,500 and 2,000 different resources at this point in time that the veteran can connect with. And they can also download it from this site of their resources. So that's why I'm really passionate about this program. So that's why I'm really coming today to just promote this program, because I really need this program up and running.
They've been in my office several times.
I know. But you got to admit, it's non-threatening. I mean, if you talk to a soldier and say, okay, call him military helpline, no. Because they know, I mean, that's good for suicide. Yes, that is awesome for suicide. And if they need help on that side, but ones that have good tours, they're just wanting resources. I have resources if they want snow tires, if they want their electric paid, if they want rent paid. We have VFW that does a lot of this stuff. But no one really knows. And it's one place that you can get one resource.
Go on.
Thank you.
And thank you, Kim.
Thank you, Peter.
My name is Peter Barclay, United States Air Force from 89 to 98. I started my career worrying that they're going to send me all over the world, and they sent me to Sacramento. But after that, they decided to do exactly that, and they sent me everywhere. One of the next places they sent me was Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma. They combat trained me, got me ready, went all over the world from Germany, Italy, Bosnia, handled not deny flight for Bosnia, did all kinds of different crazy stuff, sent me over to Korea for a year. Being in Oklahoma was interesting because I was there in 1995. And being the most well-trained person at the time, I was the first responder for the Oklahoma City bombing. I came back from that bombing completely changed. 9 years after that of my career, I started having flashbacks in control rooms that managed the communication for the space shuttle and $1.1 billion worth of satellite assets. I didn't get to finish my career. Don't get retirement. I'm now permanently disabled. I lost my last job because I was having flashbacks at work and scaring everybody else. And I wanted to start off by talking to you a little bit about respect, because I wanted to make sure that I told you up front, Honorable Chair Senator Boquist, Senator Moniz Anderson, and Senator Olson, all of you, that I have a deep, tremendous respect for not just you, but all members of our government. I've actually got the opportunity. I was talking to Chief Justice DeMunis, and I'm taking my daughter to go see him on Thursday, and she is about as excited as getting to go see Brad Pitt. Okay? This is the level of respect that I've got instilled in my kids, and the level of respect that I think that everybody should have for our judges, our governors, just the people in the offices. These are people who are working for America and for Oregon. That said, I have absolutely no qualms in getting in someone's face when they're doing their job wrong, and if they're doing it in a way that actually causes more harm than good. I greatly appreciate everything that you guys have done, but there are things that really upset me. I was actually very hurt by some of the comments that you made in your questions, Senator Monanderson. You were making comments about bipolar and borderline. I'm not sure what your psychological degree history is, but borderline and bipolar are not bad things.
I know.
They're not. But in the context that I heard you, it came across as, well, these are just bipolar and they're already messed up and screwed up people. And I'm sure you didn't mean it that way, but it comes that way. But that's an automatic assumption that comes to our veterans. I sat there listening to our first presenter. I'm terribly sorry. I'm very bad with names and my memory is not the greatest. I'm also very scatterbrained. My brain is completely changed. They've actually got it medically documented. I didn't like the male stereotyping. Mm-hmm. Men don't like to talk. Well, I'm going to tell you right now, I wouldn't be so hurt by your comments if I didn't have the same feelings that every other man, woman, and child in this country have. Culturally, we may have been told not to talk. You talk, you're going to lose your security clearance. You talk, you're going to do this. And culturally, we're told to tell others, you talk and they'll take your clearance. So don't you talk because I need your manpower. That stereotyping is prevalent everywhere. And one of the things that I was talking to Chief Justice, I actually wrote him a letter. It's huge because I want him to pass it on to all the other judges because I hold what I consider a kinship with them because I consider judges to be, although they don't get shot at, they also hold the morals of our society on their shoulder every day to do their job, just as our soldiers hold that weight on their shoulders every single day. And I needed to send him a letter to tell him that, and I wanted to explain to him that he needs to make sure they ensure that their robes deserve the respect by making sure that they pay attention to that. The male stereotype crushes us in the courtrooms. I was talking to House Representative Andy Olson, and I was talking about my issue, and he brought up the idea, well, what about a driver's license waiver? And I was like, I'm telling you that we have kids with medical problems not getting stuff and this, and you're telling me about a $50 waiver every 8 years for something. And he tells me about it, and the reason being is because he's got a law enforcement background, and he wants to know who's got PTSD. So that when a cop pulls him over, he's warned, and we're doing this for your safety, Peter. We want to make sure that if we know, I have PTSD. PTSD from a bombing. When I become in an episode of a flashback, I either just completely fugue state, lay on the ground, don't do a thing, I might scream and yell, or I start digging. I dig. Dig out closets, I dig out the cupboards, I make a huge pile of everything in one section of the house. I don't hurt people, I don't do anything that's harmful. If I come up to somebody and somebody tries to stop me, I stop. I've never done anything to hurt anyone. But automatically, because you have PTSD, you're assumed to be some crazy lunatic who's going to try to snap somebody's neck. And not even every veteran who'd have that license waiver has PTSD. So how much are you automatically assuming all of these things about somebody and creating stereotypes on people because of this? We are isolated from our civilian counterparts. Why? Not just because our jobs don't translate, but because we don't even qualify for the same benefits. My wife is also a veteran. She's Army. She got a 10% rating for her service and the injuries that she took. And before we got married, her daughter, we were both previously married. Her daughter was qualifying for OHP. And the reason for that is because she used to work at the Oregon State Hospital. If you remember from a couple of years ago, the nurses there were getting beat up by the patients because they were taking in the forensics people, all the people from court that were criminally insane. They'd send them in there and they'd beat up the nurses. My wife was one of them. She got beat up, couldn't work. Her daughter started qualifying for OHP. As soon as OHP found out that she was the dependent of a veteran, she no longer qualified for medical or dental. Once we got married, I was able to take care of her under my CHAMP VA program, but I'm paying $100 a year through Social Security. In order for her to be eligible, I have to pay Social Security for a medical benefit that I never use. I go to the VA, and if I go to the emergency, I hugely sick this weekend, had to go to the ER. That's covered by the VA. I'm paying $100 a month so that she can have CHAMP VA, which covers medical only at 75%. Whereas I know another gentleman who's 25 years old. He's just having a hard, he's regular average go guy, just having a hard time, barely holding on to a minimum wage job, gets OHP for $9 a month, covers him 100% medical, 100% dental. My daughter gets completely disqualified from that program simply because I'm a veteran. We don't get what civilians get. And that's a huge problem when it comes to my issues, when it comes to divorce. Because when you're part of the veteran's family, you suffer that together. But as soon as you're separated, that separated family starts qualifying for all of those benefits, and the courts ignore that fact. The courts look at me and say, you've got PTSD, you're an abuser, you beat your wife, you're a horrible man, you must do all these offensive things. And if someone even just makes the claim, you spend all your time putting all the documentation in the world, people on the stand to say, this is all lies. And the judge is going to go, I don't care. I'm going to still just sandbag you. I've been court ordered to pay over $2,600 every month of my VA disability. And if you think that that's, oh, they're not using my VA, well, I only get $900 in Social Security, so where do you think the other part's coming from? Now, we have a law in this country. It's called Title 38, 5301. That's the current version of it. This is a federal law. It has been taken to the United States Supreme Court on multiple occasions, and it has been ruled that that law is so extensive, so thorough. This is a law that started off in the first Congress of our federal Congress and is signed into law by George Washington, okay? Updated in the 12th, updated in the 92nd. It's been updated and updated, made more strong and more thorough and more encompassing, and ruled by the United States Supreme Court that it is so encompassing that it can protect against any claim from anyone, including the claim of a wife, a child, a conjoined twin doesn't have a claim. The United States Court actually, Justice O'Connor actually quoted making her comments about these opinions and self-admitted that these are an opinion that the court disdains. They don't just disagree with that, with the idea that these benefits would be available for the family and not protected by 5301. But they're absolutely disgusted by it. They disdain that idea. Now, there was a case that went up, and they said, look, we are giving you benefits for both you and the child. And that's why there is a provision, and people don't seem to understand that there's a difference between the way the laws are working for veterans, because when we usually write laws, we write laws that say, okay, here's what you can do, and these are exceptions. 5301 works backwards. You can't do nothing except here's some provisions. That's the way the veteran law works. It says you can't do this, but 5307 says you can give the child their portion. You can give a spouse their portion. It doesn't say you can give a divorced spouse or a ex-wife a portion. The Oregon Court of Appeals has been making judgments regarding veterans' disability and divorce courts, and they have decided to take an absolutely ridiculous stance. And I have so much respect for judges, but I'm going to tell you right now, this ruling disgusts me beyond means. And the fact that it was made shows a complete lack of intelligence of the law. The ruling in simplicity basically states, because the United States Supreme Court has never said there's no such thing as unicorns, therefore they must solely exist. They must absolutely exist, and because they exist, I'm going to be able to punch your kid in the head. That's what they've ruled. The Supreme Court's using a ruling that went to the Supreme Court called Mansell versus Mansell. It was a ruling on military retirement. That's something that falls under the United States Code under Section 10. Has nothing to do with Title 38 for veterans. Under Title 10, there's a law that says you can use this much and how much of military retirement as disposable income for child support, alimony, and this. And this is how you're supposed to do it. And it has provisions. And it amazes me that they're even using the case of Mansell, because I'll explain in a second. But the provisions say this is how you can do this, but then there's a couple exceptions, because this is how much retirement you will get. But then we're going to remove some because of these reasons. And those exceptions say, well, this is how much you can actually use, because this is how much they're actually getting. And the Oregon Court of Appeals has said, because they only said under Title 10, they identified one of these funds that is funds that are waived. It's military retirement that you have to give up in order to get your disability. It's waived retirement. That protects the disability. That doesn't protect the disability. They say it protects the disability, which is even a unique concept in its own if you follow their logic that way. But it doesn't. It's simply protecting the waived retirement. If you want to check what protections are of the disability, you got to go to Title 38. That's the way the law works. That's the way the United States Supreme Court says it works. That's the way it works. Following their logic makes obscene sense. Following their logic says we're going to protect the disability of retirees that gets waived, but we're not going to protect the disability received on its own, because you got injured before you could retire, because you got hurt so bad you can't stay in the military. We're going to punish you because you couldn't stay in. That same logic, we define dependents, and we talk about who's family and who's eligible for dependent status by putting definitions into the law. And under 38, we have a definition for children to make sure that they can get their benefits, and that's what that's there for. Okay? And there's a huge definition for children. It's 2 pages long, small print. I got a copy of it here. It's 2 pages, small print, single space. Letter I sent you was double. This is huge to define what a child is. You look under there, and according to the Oregon Supreme Court's logic, if an adult person goes through the legal process of separating themselves from the veteran's family, they have more rights and more authority to gain access to that veteran's benefits than a child that I adopted that just happens to not be living with me. If I adopt my daughter Liliana formally, and then my wife and I were to separate, and Liliana's not living with me, she's not eligible for benefits by the VA. So Oregon would say that a divorced spouse, someone who wants to get rid of their veteran spouse, has more rights than somebody that I personally went to court, went and filled out paperwork and said, I want this as my child. I want this responsibility. This is their logic. It makes no sense. I am pushing a case to the United States Supreme Court. And people go, well, it's family court. They're never going to listen to it. Oh, they get thousands of cases. They're never going to listen. Really? Wisner versus Wisner, Mansell versus Mansell, McCarty versus McCarty, Rose versus Rose, Hiscardo versus Hiscardo. I can go on and on. The United States Supreme Court loves to hear cases when it has to do with a conflict between the federal and the state laws. And this is a prime case. So yes, I'm very hopeful that they're going to hear it. Now, the other part of this is that there was a case that went up. It was called Rose v. Rose. And it was that case where the veteran was trying to work this really finagly method of saying that he wasn't going to have to make a payment to his ex-wife. We get jaded in divorces. We all do. We all get mad at the other one. And the best way to take it out is in money and collateral damage. And I'm going to tell you right now, Mr. Rose, in this case, I would have popped him in the head. He was an idiot. When it comes to your kids, you don't do that. Okay? And it was a very intriguing case. And that quote, the piece I told you about being disdained, that came from that case, Rose v. Rose. Because in that case, they actually did hold the veteran in contempt. And the states will use this, and the courts will use this and say, oh, they said we can use veteran benefits for support awards. No. They said some very specific special conditions had to exist in order to do this. And they ignore 26 years of history that's happened since then. This case happened in 1987. Actually, before I hit this case, I'm going to go back to the Mansell thing real quick before I forget it. The reason why I'm so intrigued by the Mansell case is that they're using a case that shows just absolutely obscenely that states, in and of themselves, will automatically refuse to follow the federal law when it supersedes. The Supreme Court has stated over and over and over, and everybody will cite it. It says all the way back to 1904, in every single case they've ever dealt with family court, they always say there's these two major things that you have to prove in order for the federal government to supersede in family law. They say, we respect states in that area. Absolutely. They have full reign. But we will, and in every single one of the cases that I mentioned, they did, which means that they were doing this damage. It says that they have to do major damage, in quotes, to the clear and substantial federal interest. Every single one of those cases was proof that the states were doing clear and substantial damage. They were doing major clear and substantial damage to the federal interest. And when you talk about veterans and our national security, you're talking about damage to the ability to take care of our country, our armed forces, the people who are protecting it. Senator Boquist, how would you feel if you went back and told all of those veterans and all of those soldiers out there and said, you know what? You know how we told you that if you get disability, you can never get it taken away? Guess what? It'll get taken away. And it can. Mm-hmm. Explain to me what's going to happen to an all-volunteer force when you say the promise that was made by George Washington and has been instilled ever since has been taken away.
Yeah, one of the interesting things you raise is that, and I'm familiar with this, and the fact that I think when I enlisted in 1975, there, and you were back then, there were 22, there was a sheet of 22 things the federal government was going to get you to be a veteran. I think when I got out, we're down to like one or two left because the federal government had taken away, including water rights and the Klamath Basin. It's all kinds of things right there. I mean, you're absolutely correct.
A horse and a mule and two cows.
Yeah, right. I mean, I guess the question I'd have is, what do you think we as legislators can do to help?
Well, for us in Oregon, let me ask you that question back. Are you absolutely powerless? If the courts, if you wrote a law that says that you have to write, if you have to wear a seatbelt, you write the law, must wear a seatbelt. And the executive branch of our government decides, well, tell the police, arrest them if they're wearing seatbelts. Not just don't enforce this, go absolutely against it. And say, if they're wearing it, arrest them. And then they walk into the court, into our judicial branch, and the judge says, nope, that's true too. And I'm going to tell you right now, you wear that seatbelt again, I'm going to put you in jail if you do it. I'm going to fine you every single time, and then I'm going to put you in jail if you keep doing it, and I'm going to call it contempt of court. So tell me, do you really have no power if the courts were doing that, what would you do?
Well, one of the problems the legislature faces, and it's not just the courts.
I understand. Here,
not just the courts, because as you well know, we're sitting in a 29-day session, and mm-hmm. we've already been in four arguments with the executive branch, and they've told us, you know, I think to go pound sand several times, and we've told them to go pound sand several times, and now they're kind of coming to a compromise, but then we're going to leave, and the three of us are going to go back to work, you know, next month, back at our jobs, and the challenge that we're going to face is that we don't have as much leverage as we think. We have the kind of the bully pulpit. I mean, we can propose laws, we can pass laws and send them to even to the judiciary, but the problem then is sometimes they ignore them. As you point out in the veterans courts, we have a law mm-hmm. in which we have a veterans court, but the counties don't have to do it. Some counties do it. And, you know, we kind of use the bully pulpit, which is the same as today. You know, we invite veterans to come over and raise the issues and then try and see what we can figure out to make
that's
work.
That's an interesting response. Because I understand, and unlike a lot of people that I've met, that we have these three branches, and they're brothers or sisters. They're equals. They're not subservient to each other. The executive branch doesn't boss around the legislation and say, do this, do that. And for the most part, I mean, you guys, when you get into these sessions, you really get into head-to-head situations. But for the most part, on the daily issues, you guys work pretty good together. You know? When I was trying to get a form change done, the judicial branch, Chief Justice Dominguez's judicial committee for doing these forms said, you know what, there is actually no ruling specific to the question that you brought, because it went to the whole child support thing, but it didn't go to spousal. He's like, you know what, I'm going to send the question out to the DOJ. I'm going to send the question out to these people and those people. He didn't send it to the VA. But, you know, he sent it out and said, hey, tell me what's going on. What should I do here? And I've seen collaboration between all of the branches, especially in the daily deal grind, and they do listen to each other, and they listen to each other well. And I'm telling you right now that if I brought you that copy of that form, and I said, you know what? This does an awesome job of making sure that we can make sure that the benefits get to the children. Because right now, Oregon's going to tell you that they're doing this for the sake of the children, and you know what they're doing? They're actually causing harm. They're delaying the veteran benefit payments from the VA to the child by getting in the middle of it, by trying to do this whole division. I try to tell them a simple analogy. I say, look, VA benefits, you might as well treat them like food stamps. If somebody walked into your office at the OCSE and or walked into court and said, hey, we're getting divorced and we get a food stamp card and she's got it. I want some of the food stamps. Make her give me some of the food stamps. The court would look at me and want to smack me in the head. They'd say, go back to the food stamp office, make them divide it, and give you two cards. The United States Department of Health and Human Services has a section called the ACF, the Administration for Children and Families. And they give us millions of dollars in budget. And I've been talking to Mark Greenberg. He is an awesome guy. I should say the Honorable Mark Greenberg. He is the Assistant Secretary in charge of ACF. He basically only one guy between him and the President. And I'm talking to him, and I'm begging him not to cut Oregon's funding because we're violating these laws. Because by doing so, it would hurt all the rest of the children. The ACF has the job of saying you're required by federal law to have child support enforcement as long as you follow our policies. And according to this, you're violating the enforcement policies, you're violating the calculation policies, you're sitting there and violating veterans, you're violating not only the ACF policies, you're violating HSS policies. And according to our laws, we're required to stop funding you. Do you know how much of Oregon's CSE budget, offices, lights, people, all that good stuff, relies on the funds from the ACF? Two-thirds. You want to fire two-thirds of your child support enforcement people? You want to shut down those offices? That's what you're looking at. Right now, ACF is examining and doing a review on Oregon. And in a letter I submitted to him yesterday, I said, please don't cut the funding. That doesn't do any good. It just hurts more children. please come down. And I provided a thing. I said, look, just give them back these policies and say, look, these laws have been in place. Okay? Because the Rose v. Rose case came down and said all these specific circumstances to do this. But they identified a lot of really great things in there. One was that they were saying that the states could do apportionments. And that was in 87. And in 88, the United States Congress came out with the Veteran Judicial Review Act and said, okay, no, we're declaring supremacy and complete supremacy over all of these things. So no, you can't do that. The next thing that happened was they found out that the VA, who was supposed to do these apportionments, splitting the benefits and giving them to the child, wasn't doing that. So George Bush Sr., H.W. Bush, fired the VA. There's no such thing as the VA anymore. We use that as a common term, but there is no such thing as a VA. It's called the United States Department of Veteran Affairs. George Bush fired the VA because of this. He created the United States Department of Veteran Affairs, put the director as the secretary as one of his cabinet members so that he could personally grab him by the coattails and say, what the hell are you doing if you don't do your job? Since then, they've been doing thousands of apportionments. The ACF provided policy that said, look, all you got to do is fill out this one-page form. We worked with them to get it real simple. All you do is a one-page form and you'll get your benefits. Usually takes about 2 weeks.
I'm going to ask you to try and wrap up because Mr. Yeah. Thornton is behind you too.
I will.
And can you get me a copy of the form?
Yeah. Actually, I think I gave you a copy. No, actually, that was just the table on certain things. I will get you a copy of two different forms. One is the form from that the person applies, and the second is a form that gets sent to the CSE office to say, you know what, based on all the income that the veteran does have outside of his veteran benefits, how much support can you award? And then tell us what the actual need of the child is. And then that way, when we do our apportionment, we can try to fill that. Because we'll typically use anywhere between, we're not going to hand you just the child's benefit that we added to the veteran side, because we know that it doesn't take two toasters to run a house. We don't need two kitchens. We don't need two living rooms. It doesn't take double the amount for two people. It just takes a little bit more. They typically award a minimum of 20% of the benefit to the child. Okay? That's a pretty healthy size award, considering it's more than any state court awards.
Well, if you can just support, I appreciate any questions.
No, but I do want to, when you bring the next panel up, right. I wanted to.
Because I need to get Mr. Thornhill up here, too.
So thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. Again, I have so much respect for all of you and all of the members of here. I would like to say one of the things that I've added is a very disturbing piece. It's concerning the communications that I had with the Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs that demonstrates that there is a considerable lack of understanding of civics and the ability to do that job. And it really concerns me.
You can give me a copy of that. I appreciate
it. It's in a copy of your piece.
In the testimony here.
It's listed as the communications between me and Director Willis.
Okay, appreciate that. And I appreciate both of you mm-hmm. coming forth and spending time with us today so that we can hear what is really happening on the ground and from your perspective. And then I'm going to ask Mr. Thornhill to come up because I know he's been patiently waiting back there.
Well, if I can urge you guys just to go to the San Diego 211. It is online, and just take a look at it and go, you know, to see what it has, the capabilities. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Thornhill, if you would, please.
And as he comes up, there are some things that both Peter and Tina brought up that, you know, maybe in the future looking at. One, Cheyenne, VSOs on campus.
Right, I have that one.
I'd like some information on the Veterans Court, where it's working, where it's not.
Go ahead, Mr. Thornhill.
And then children of veterans getting OHP. I'd like to get some information.
We can get some from
OHP too.
Over here.
Yeah.
Get some from the whatever we're calling that mega agency now.
Yeah.
Right.
Oregon Health Authority.
Thank you very much again, Mr. Thornhill. Didn't we see you 2 weeks ago? And didn't we fail? Is not that the word here? We sent it to the House, and they're sending it back to us. Go ahead, Mr. Thornhill.
Thanks, sir. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert Thornhill. I thank you for this opportunity to discuss veterans' issues of concern to me. The volume of my written testimony would indicate I have several concerns. However, there are really not that many concerns per se. Former bosses, the finest men who ever wore our nation's uniforms, taught me not to bring them a problem unless I brought a recommended solution. Thus, along with the matters of concern or ideas of how those concerns and other issues might be addressed. Those bosses also taught me to exploit opportunities. In this instance, I've tried. I thank you for this opportunity. And with your permission, I would like to summarize or try to summarize what is in my written testimony.
Go forth.
My primary concern is jobs for veterans. Jobs are essential to veterans' reintegration into civilian society. A civilian job is the foundation on which all else done for veterans rests. Patterned somewhat after the Veterans Preference Act of 1944 on the federal level, Oregon enacted a law in 2007, Senate Bill 822, providing veterans with hiring preference for public civil service positions with state, county, city, and certain local government organizations in Oregon. We know that the preference system works at the federal level. Recent reports indicate that 26.3% of the federal non-postal employees are veterans, far outnumbering their representation in the national civilian workforce. We don't know if Oregon's system works, primarily because, as indicated in my written testimony, it has not been implemented by all organizations to which it applies. Also, we don't know because Oregon does not have a system of reporting veterans' employment as exists at the federal level. It is a disgrace, in my opinion, that almost 5 years after its enactment, Oregon's preference system has not been fully implemented. Veterans who have laid life and limb on the line deserve better. The taxpayers who pay the salaries of the bureaucrats responsible for this program deserve better. Of course, veterans' preference will not create jobs, nor does the government have civilian jobs for every veteran looking for work. But veterans should be given the preference for the few government jobs available and for which they qualify and for which the law intends. I believe the immediate aim ought to be to fix the problem, not fix blame. I have made suggestions in my written testimony on how the problem of non-implementation might be fixed now. Those state officials paid to deal with veterans' issues may have better issues. I recommend this committee invite them to appear and explain what actions have been taken and underway to fix the problem. These kinds of oversight hearings, in my experience, seem to concentrate and focus attention of those called before them. I've made several recommendations in my written testimony, most aimed toward the increasing employment of veterans or family members. I hope you will find some of them worthy of your attention for the next session of the legislature. And if I may, for the benefit of those behind me in the audience, I'd like to briefly describe them. One, the first one deals directly with the implementation of the Veterans Preference Statutes. It is that the Director of Veterans Affairs used ample resources available to him and his immediate staff to contact each and every organization subject to veteran preference statutes to ensure that they understand them and have implemented them. Number two, that the state put into effect a requirement that state activity heads annually report on the veterans' employment in their activity. Such reports will give some indication that the veteran preference system is working, and hopefully the numbers reported will set a high standard for lower levels of government and for private sector employers. Number three, that state require contractors working on designated state contracts to conduct recruitment outreach to veterans, similar to the requirement of Title 38 of the U.S. Code 4212 on the federal level. Number four, that the Senate pass a resolution similar to U.S. Senate Resolutions 373, November 2007, urging all employers, government and private sector, to give hiring priority to qualified veterans. Copy of that resolution is included with my written testimony. Five, that the legislature amend Oregon preference system to also give hiring preference to widows of deceased and 100% disabled service members. Six, that this committee cause an audit to be conducted of the state overhead involved with the administration of veteran benefits to see if the system cannot be made more efficient and less costly thus free tax dollars for other urgent needs. 7, that the system be made less cluttered and misleading by repealing Section 2 of House Bill 3207, which, contrary to its parent intent, provides no benefit whatsoever and assigns a function to ODVA more appropriately performed in the employment department.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3207, was that, which year was that passed?
2011.
2011, thanks.
Those are my concerns and a few ideas of how they might be addressed. Thank you for this opportunity again to testify. I hope you will find some of my testimony of benefit in your work. Before I leave this chair, however, on behalf of my veteran comrades, I thank you for what you do here in Salem, not only for veterans, but for their families, but for all Oregonians. And I especially thank your staff for the advice, help, and many courtesies extended me. I think I know now why this place seems to run so smoothly.
You're on our side of the chamber. It ain't going to be running smoothly at 10:30 when I'm non-concurring with our colleagues in the House. So,
I thank you again. I'll try to, please be try to answer any questions.
So my takeaway here is I do recall SB 822, is that during the interim to go back and the short list I have is a little longer than yours, is to go back and review SB 822 and kind of get an update from that, from not only ODVA but from DAS, who is actually the holder of all of information like that, and from Boley, who has had experience in trying to implement that, and some of that experience not been successful, and then maybe get from Boley how to improve the existing system. And, the second thing I noted from you, that it's already on our agenda, and so we're not all out of sync here, is we already do have a series of review audits set up with ODVA and with the military department. That we passed last session, and we're just starting down that rank. But the legislature moves slowly, as you know. It has taken us several years to get the community college bill that we passed out of this committee that you testified on over to the House. The House has decided that they don't agree with what we are. And so it might not be this year, and it might be in January or February. So speed is not one of the things the legislature does well. I think that's why we have a citizen legislature. So it plods along kind of about the speed of a platypus or something. So the other thing I have in here is a review of House Bill 3207 during the interim. And we have probably two or three more interim committee meetings over the next 9 months before we come into the next session. And so that's kind of the takeaways I have. Did I miss something?
No, sir.
Okay. And did either of you want to add anything else to the interim work plan? I know Senator Monis Anderson raised things up here.
You mentioned everything.
And yeah, if you have anything else that you would like to put on the interim, the continuing interim work plan, please get it to Cheyenne, and then we'll send a draft around to everybody before we go in, because I believe we have to give the presiding officer a work plan before the end of, before we leave here. When that is, nobody knows. So with that,
hopefully this week.
Mr. Thornhill, I appreciate that, and I do have one thing that you could do for me.
I'll certainly try, sir.
Is you could go back to your nimble fingers in your email system, and I am looking, or we as a committee are looking, to identify individuals that may have the dependents of deceased service members or wives of deceased service members who have had problems in community colleges in getting either the tuition waiver or the first dollar or the last dollar. I think you're familiar with this issue.
Yes, sir.
And because our colleagues in the House have been on the record and saying, if you can just provide us one real example, we'll take action. And so our committee members are out looking for that example of where there is actually a problem with a dependent of a deceased service member killed on active duty in the category that is having a challenge. Because many, we know for a fact, and we've heard names thrown around, but since there's no record keeping, as you pointed out, there's a problem with veterans record keeping, we don't have their names and we can't find them. And so we're looking from the various veterans organizations to try and get us that information, both the posts, the VFWs, the American Legion, and other organizations that might know of one of those dependents that has had challenges that we could assist.
I'll join the search.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Are there any other items, Madam Vice Chair? With that, I appreciate everybody coming, and the, I guess, final, we believe, meeting of the Senate Committee on Veterans and Military Affairs in the short session is over.